Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast, where good taste... something sound effect. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic of no renown. With me, as always, is a film critic of some renown.
You have a job. You write good for articles and stuff. At Slash Film.
I write good for articles.
You write way more than I do on a typical any time right now.
I have been more productive in the last month than I've been in like the last 4 years.
I know, it's been really exciting.
It's been pretty insane.
I love reading his work at Slash Film. Anyway, my name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. I sometimes write for The Wrap, but mostly I do my stuff here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. This is Critically Acclaimed. We review movies, and we've got a bunch of them for you this week. We're going to be reviewing the new releases. Hold on, that's not that.
We actually don't have a lot of them this week.
Well,
it's a light week in terms of reviews, but we're gonna have plenty of talking to do.
For us, it's a light week. There's some people who spend an entire podcast talking about only one new release. I don't know how they do it. We are reviewing the new releases, The Lost City, You Are Not My Mother, and Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. But before we get into any of that, there was a certain event that took place this last weekend. An event that rhymes, of course, with Schlossker.
Schlossker is what they called it on Tiny Toon Adventures.
Yes, Bugs Bunny was like, my beloved Schlossker.
They couldn't call Oscar, because that's
trademarked.
But when they won a film award in the world of Tiny Toon Adventures, they called it Schlossker.
Yeah, Bugs was obsessed with his Schlossker.
And it was stolen by Slappy Stanley, voiced by Jonathan Winters.
I remember talking about Schlossker a lot.
And that was, in a weird way, my introduction to Columbo.
who was Columbo?
Babs and Buster were both Columbo.
Oh, that's fine.
And I didn't understand that joke.
I don't think I would have understood that. That probably flew entirely over my head.
Like, I'd seen Columbo at that point, but I didn't really put it together. It's like, why are they acting so weird?
Yeah. Well, in any case, the Oscars were this last week, and it was the 94th Annual Academy Awards. Whitney and I did an Oscar preview last week, in which we talked about most of the nominees. There's a few we hadn't seen, mostly in the documentary and international awards, but we'd seen almost all of the nominees this year, and we talked about who we thought should win, and who we thought would win. And just as a sort of just a friendly wager, we waged bitter battle over who could predict the most Academy
Awards. We didn't have a wager, we just sort of tried to see who could guess the most. And it was a dead heat throughout most of the show.
You were ahead for most of it. You were ahead after like about a third of the way into the show, and I could not catch up to you, but it was super duper close. And then right at the end, we had two of the last categories were Best Actress and Best Picture, and we both picked differently, and my two picks for those won.
And mine were not.
Yeah.
I chose Kristen Stewart as the spot on to win, and she did not win.
Jessica Chastain
did win, and fine.
Yep. I'm good performance.
I have no beef with any of the wins, really.
No.
Except for Animated Short. Animated Short was the one that kind of upset me.
We'll talk about that in a minute. People like Dune a lot more than I do, but...
I can't fault the technicals on
that. I can fault a couple of the technicals, but I'll let that slide until we talk about it further. Basically, what it boiled down to is that I underestimated the Academy's love for Dune, and Whitney underestimated the Academy's love for Coda. And that's kind of it. That's kind of what it all boiled down to. We're going to talk a little bit about the actual winners, and then we'll talk a little about the awards show themselves, because that was a whole damn thing.
There's several cans of worms. Yeah. They need to be opened.
Real fast, there were 8 Academy Awards that were announced prior to the show. And it was weird, because they clearly pre-recorded some of the red carpet segments. So if you were watching the red carpet, you could watch Jason Momoa, who gave out, with Josh Brolin, a lot of those early awards, most of them technical, also the shorts. He was giving an interview on the red carpet while people were releasing like cell phone footage of him announcing the awards in the actual
Oscar
stadium.
That's so bizarre.
And the red carpet was a lie. They couldn't even keep the red carpet straight.
The whole point of the red carpet, like the carpet to enter the, the party venue, is that people are going in. They're filing in and finding their seats.
Yeah. It just lets you know this is the entrance to the theater. That's why it's red.
These famous people are all going in, and we're going to gather around either side and watch all the famous people go in.
Yeah. And then there would be and then some people would do quick snippet interviews. Hey, Helen Mirren.
Yeah. Eventually,
tell me about Gosford Park.
Putting not just photographers, but also reporters or critics.
Roger Ebert used to do that. And I was very obsessed with Roger Ebert because he was the only person on the red carpet who would ask actual questions about the movies and not just like, I appreciate who are you wearing, everyone's looking nice, but that's a quick question, it doesn't require a lot, and then you've got like a minute to kill, and it's always like, what was it like working with blah, and it's like, I'll bet they're gonna say it was good because they're on camera. I don't think they're gonna say, yeah, you know who sucked while we were making Belfast? Kenneth Branagh. What a dick. That's never gonna happen.
We all called him Benedict Fucker.
Yeah. That's always been one of my fantasies, to do the red carpet at the Academy Awards and ask actual decent questions.
I'd like to be one of the celebrities on the red carpet and not answer anything honestly. Like, who are you wearing? Your mom. Just be totally rude about it.
Nice. So that was weird. It turns out they can give out the Academy Awards really, really quick if they get rid of all the clutter, because they gave out the first 8 Academy Awards in about 35, 40 minutes.
They could just have done the whole show that way.
Honestly, make it quick. Yeah, I'm actually fine with that. Like, I understand you want to play the songs. Fine. Do one of the songs, give out 4 awards. Do one of the songs, give out 4 awards. Mm. We could still be out of here in 90 minutes.
Yeah, there was one year, and my wife Angie reminded me of this, where they played all of the songs prior. The songs went prior to the show.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty cool because you don't take up a lot of
real estate in the actual,
in the actual show.
I didn't remember that.
And it's also incentive to watch, like, the pre-show of the game beforehand.
That's not a bad idea. I don't recall. I kind of recall. Did you remember what year that was?
It was...
Like, what was nominated?
It was over a decade ago at this point,
That's not the worst idea I've ever heard.
I don't recall, but...
That
seemed like an okay idea. Yeah. The whole goal of doing the show the way they did was...
This year.
Presumably, A, to beef up ratings, and B, to cut down on time.
Mm-hmm.
Ratings were a little higher.
Yeah, a little higher. I think it helps that last year it was pandemic movies. Most people hadn't seen them.
And it was a little longer.
It was 3 hours and I think 42 minutes. It was the longest ceremony since the Shape of Water one, which is almost 5 years ago. So that fucking failed.
Yeah.
And what happened was, here's what they fucking did. They gave away the Oscars, like, ahead of time, those 8 Oscars. And then they cut to them in the middle of the show. And they would announce the nominees like you normally would, except instead of having an actual like presenter, it was just whoever did the voiceovers. Yeah. And then they would announce who won. Sometimes they didn't announce the names of the winners. They just announced the name of the movie, which I thought was pretty fucked up. Yeah. Basically, and then they showed most, not necessarily all, of the actual speech. Apparently someone noted, Phil Lord, I think, tweeted about how... I forget who it was. Someone who won one of the early Academy Awards had a bit in their speech about how important the below-the-line workers are on a film. You know, mostly the people who are getting awards before the show. Apparently that got cut.
God.
Fuckers. But it was weird when they would just sort of cram them in. Like, they would throw them out kind of willy-nilly. Didn't make a lot of sense. And towards the end of the show, when everything completely flew off the rails, and yeah, we'll talk about that, after there was a pretty severe controversy... it's like they forgot to give out Best Makeup and Hairstyling because they just threw it in right before Best Actress.
They did it in between Director and Actress. They
Which
brought
is
up
the
best
antepenultimate. Makeup, yeah. The antepenultimate award was makeup, which usually you save the big ones for the end. Nope, makeup. I think they forgot.
I literally think they forgot. It was. Just to whinge about the show a little bit.
Yeah.
It was completely unprofessional. It was really, really hastily slapped together. It felt like they designed it a week before.
Well,
like they didn't have the anything in place. They didn't have the plans.
In some cases they did. Like Beyonce only confirmed that she could perform like a week ago.
Mm.
And the performance, which was like live in like a tennis court in Compton, because a big tie into King Richard, was fine. Beyonce knows how to put on a show. It was weird that everyone was wearing tennis ball light green. Like, that was an odd choice, but whatever. That was fine. But later on in the show, they kept saying, in addition to all the normal songs they were going to sing, the nominated songs, that we're finally going to play for the first time live.
Mm.
We don't talk about Bruno. First off, that is not nominated, so that's an interesting choice. And secondly... when they finally did play it.
They got Megan Thee Stallion.
They got Megan Thee Stallion to do a rap verse and change all the lyrics to the song so that it was about being at the Oscars, and they referred to all three of the show's hosts, Wanda Sykes, Regina Hall, and Amy Schumer, as hoes, which I thought was an interesting choice for a Disney song in a kids movie. My theory is that when Beyonce hadn't confirmed, that was going to be the opening number, and it was going to be about the Oscars.
Oh, but they had already rehearsed, but
Megan Thee Stallion
had already signed on.
Yeah, so they had to put it somewhere, and it made no sense whatsoever. And if you actually were excited to actually see the performers from Encanto sing We Don't Talk About Bruno, which is, you know, great song, very, very popular, boy, were you disappointed, because they changed all the lyrics and half the cast didn't do it. Fuck you.
I did appreciate that John Leguizamo, who plays the part of Bruno in Encanto, came out to introduce the song. It's like, and they didn't ask me, because actually I didn't perform the song. But I'm Bruno. TF.
The other song nominees were, let's say, they played No Time to Die, which, by the way, Billie Eilish is apparently the first person born in the 21st century to win an Oscar.
Oh, good for her.
That's an interesting bit of trivia, I felt. Let's see, Van Morrison didn't play, and they played Dos Oruguitas from Encanto, but I was very excited. You know, there's this movie called 4 Good Days starring Mila Kunis and Glenn Close, and they got Trish from Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar to perform that song, and I thought that was really, really cool.
Trish from
Barb and Star.
Who was the actor who played Trish?
It's Reba McEntire. That's the joke.
Oh, okay.
The joke is in Barb and Star, there's a surprise cameo from Reba McEntire.
That's right. And I had forgotten I didn't put the joke together.
It's funny. I made
one. It's funny. I'm ignorant. That's
no. You're not ignorant. It's late, and you weren't. And there's a lot of references to keep track of. Let's go through. I'll say this.
Yeah. Just so we don't kind of go through category by category. The show, for however much a disaster it was, I actually don't object strenuously to anybody who won. I don't think any undeserving films or performers or craftspeople were undeserving in any kind of way. I'm happy that
there were definitely people who could have, but I think they avoided that.
You know? I am happy that after 8 nominations in 7 separate categories that Kenneth Branagh finally has an Academy Award.
That was an interesting one because, A, good for him. Belfast is a very good screenplay. Totally earned it. In fact, it's probably what I would have voted for. At least it's right up there.
That is what I voted for.
No, I would have voted for Worst Person in the World, but if it wasn't for that, I would have voted for Belfast. I was a moment that I was actually like really excited about, like, oh my god, Kenneth Branagh's getting up there. He's been doing this for so long. Is it going to be really emotional? Nope. Super professional. Thanked everyone. Got the fuck out. Didn't talk about, after so many tries. Didn't make a joke about it. Didn't make it like kind of wistful and weepy. Did the gig and left.
Despite how egotistical he is in his movies, where he always points the camera at himself and gives himself the best, meatiest roles and sweeps the camera out. You've seen his Frankenstein where he's just rolling around with his shirt off.
Oh,
and he's
my
all
God.
Greasy.
I'm going to cover myself in sexy eels.
And he's going to grow his hair long. It's alive. Look at my chest.
That was also 30 years ago. He was younger. But
I suppose so, but he didn't have to film himself all greased up with his shirt off. He's actually a pretty modest person in real life.
I've interviewed him. He was very, very nice to me. He mostly wanted to... I interviewed him for Cinderella.
Okay.
And we talked a bit about it, and, you know, I quite liked that movie, so it was a fun conversation. And towards the end, he mostly just wanted to talk about the movie Kundun for some reason. Martin Scorsese's Kundun. I don't even remember how it came up. He just really likes it and wanted to talk about it.
Great. You know what? When you're doing those press junkets, it's got to be mind-numbing after a while. You're on reporter number 100, and they're asking the same question. What was your inspiration for blah?
That was always my goal, is to not ask the questions everyone else asks, at least to be a breath of... Even if I don't get good stuff, at least I'm a breath of fresh air for the act. Finally. So that was cool.
Wonderful interview I had with Billy Bob Thornton at one point. Ooh. He said, usually I can tell if a critic likes a movie or not. Okay. And my question was, I'm a critic. What did I think? He kind of looked me over for a second as if he was reading my mind, like putting his fingers to his temple. You liked parts of it, but weren't overall impressed. It's like, well, you got me there.
That's cool. Yeah. So yeah, we're gonna run through just the winners real fast. Dune won almost all the technical stuff. It lost makeup. And I think something
To Eyes of Tammy
Faye. Eyes of Tammy Faye. And I think with good cause there. The one win for Dune that I genuinely object to, I wasn't a huge fan of Dune. We've already established this. The one thing where I'm just like, really? I still don't think it deserves production design. It's a lot of sand, a lot of rocks, and a lot of empty rooms. Empty rooms.
Like rooms that people don't live in.
Yeah, but it's their bedrooms. Mm. Like there's weirdly... Well, I appreciate it's like supposed to be stark, but there's stark, and then there's I don't believe the world you created, and that was the big flaw for me.
The people in Dune are, you know, this is future people. They behave very differently. They're not
people. Still have knickknacks.
That's true.
People still have stuff. People still make their space their own.
It's such a strange stark world that it is kind of odd that their character is named Duncan Idaho.
Yeah, right. It's like.
You know, you meet a Gurney Halleck or a Dr. Yue. It's like, that makes sense.
Yeah, that all
there's,
tracks.
There's a Thufir Hawit in the future. I believe that.
We were way off with a lot of the short films. We accurately predicted that The Queen of Basketball would win documentary short subject. Right. I'm glad it did. It's a very good film. We both thought Please Hold would win Best Live Action Short, but it went to The Long Goodbye. It was probably the odds-on favorite, but, you know, we really liked Please Hold better. The one that I was like, what? And this is the only category where I'm like, I don't think they should have won. Like, real. I mean, I get why Dune won. Mm-hmm. This one, I don't understand it. The Windshield Wiper won Best Animated Short. It's a weird choice.
Well, it was multiple styles. It was sort of this anthology film of little snippets of things, and each short had its own sort of look. So it had the most animation of any of the shorts, and I can kind of understand.
I appreciate from a stylistic perspective, some people might have been impressed. I thought it was lazy storytelling. I honestly thought it was like, yeah, hey, what's love, man? I don't know. We'll do a bunch of vignettes.
Yeah.
Cool. It's not very interesting. I actually thought it came to no meaningful conclusion, it was kind of just drab and basically was just an exercise in animation, which is okay, but there were better shorts, I thought.
I could have sworn it was going to be the sweet Christmas short about the little Robin with the mousy ears.
It's impeccable. Not only is the animation great, the story is really, really good. I'm really shocked about that. That one, totally blown away. When you actually, like, watch all the nominees, it really does seem like Robin is heads and tails, like, above the rest of it. But, I did not see that coming at all. Let's see here. Yeah, Best Original Song went to James Bond again, which... That didn't used to happen that often.
James Bond songs?
Yeah, didn't used to get nominated that often, and they definitely didn't used to win this often. Like, this is just, it's an interesting sort of streak. The last three James Bond songs in a row have all won Best Original Song. That was kind of neat.
Which, I couldn't hum this one for you, and I saw that movie.
There's just no time to die. It's just that all the Craig ones are melancholy, and I don't know why. Like, after the first two, they decided they'd all be bummers, and I'm like, all right, it's a choice.
And like I said, I've said before, I like the song from Quantum of Solace. Yeah. It's just sung badly in the movie.
Yeah, I agree. And so this is, once again, this was Lin-Manuel Miranda's opportunity to win an EGOT. He did not. And I maintain, once again, he needs to let them nominate the fun songs. This has happened multiple times. They nominated the inspirational song for Moana and not the one everyone liked, which was You're Welcome.
Which is the one all the kids are listening
to. If that had been nominated, it might have won. I stand by this. If almost any other song in Encanto had been nominated, because here's the thing, they joked about it on the show a lot. People are watching Encanto over and over again with their kids. Dos Arquitas is the only song people aren't singing over and over again afterwards. Like, this Surface Pressure would have been fine.
My son can sing We Don't Talk About Bruno.
Boom.
I think he's seen the movie twice, but he's listened to the soundtrack a bunch.
But it's an earworm. Like it would have been a fucking slam dunk. I don't understand it at all. It's really, really weird. And I'm furious. This is honestly, I'm mad that so much other shit happened at the ceremony because no one's talking about this enough. The introduction to the Best Animated Feature was a bunch of women who have played live-action Disney princesses. Mm. There was Naomi Scott from Aladdin. Mm. There was Lily James,
who played Cinderella.
Yeah, and then whoever's...
The actress who's going to play...
Ariel
in the next... Yeah,
I'll know their name by the time the movie comes out.
The poor actress who's playing Ariel, like, she was dressed like Ariel from the Main Street parade at Disneyland.
Yeah.
And she seemed terrified up there. Yeah. Like she was, this was not like something she was, like a level of fame she was used to.
A, you got all those people dressed as stars of Disney movies, dressed as their kind of like their Disney characters, about to announce Best Animated Feature. I wanted anything other than Disney to win. Like, how great would have been if Flea had won? Like, that right then. I'm like, yeah. And because Disney was all over this goddamn thing. Like, Troy Kotsur won Best Supporting Actor, and it cut to Chris Evans in a pre-recorded video congratulating Troy Kotsur and somehow managing to segue that into a trailer for his new Pixar film.
That's right.
It was so fucking gross. But what really pissed me off is, and I know it's all, I'm sure this wasn't them. I know it was all pre-written for them and on the teleprompter, but when they announced the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature, they didn't say, here are the nominees, or animation is a great medium. They said, animation, you know, what kids watch over and over again. We know you're annoyed, right, adults? The fuck is that?
Yeah, because kids are watching Flea over and over
again. They call it exclusively a children's medium, and they say that adults are annoyed by the medium.
Mm.
And that was an attitude that was throughout the entire proceedings, was just kind of being angry at cinema.
There was a segment that Wanda Sykes did where she's visiting the new Academy Museum, which is where they were hosting the ceremony this year, and she seemed kind of embarrassed or not at all knowledgeable of a lot of these, the film memorabilia that was
there. The joke is that she was oblivious to the whole, like, the actual film memorabilia that was being shown to her, and there was one kind of funny gag where they went to the Wizard of Oz room, and the only thing from the Wiz was a poster. Uh-huh. And she was like, I have the poster. That was a fair barb, I thought. But honestly, mostly it was just taking it down a notch.
Where they had a bunch of statuettes on display at the Academy Museum, including Hattie McDaniel's statuette.
Which is tragically missing.
Which I didn't know about.
And
they put a case there. It's like, and it's missing, but we wanted to sort of acknowledge her. So we at least have a space for when we find it.
Yeah.
And Wanda Sykes' joke was, you know, there's an empty case or the number of Oscars won by black directors.
Yeah. Also a fair barb. But still, the idea was, hey, here's this museum we spent a ton of money on that's here to honor cinema. Let's talk about how much it sucks. And again, the Academy Awards is a self-congratulatory premise. That's kind of the whole point. It's supposed to make people who make movies feel better about themselves so that studios could exploit them. That's why it was created by in the first place. That was Louis B. Mayer's original idea. So it's okay to let the air out of the room a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, there was a couple of good gags. I thought Amy Schumer had a couple of good gags about how Aaron Sorkin was the only person who could possibly make a movie about Lucille Ball without any laughs in it.
Right.
Which, even if you like that movie, it's not funny. It's not a comedy. Like, it's a fair point.
It's not, I mean, it's not meant to be a comedy, but yeah.
Exactly. But like, that's the thing. It's a joke, but it's also a fair point, isn't it? So all that stuff was fine. I don't know. We needed the early setup that Regina Hall was single so that she could sexually harass every man in the room. Well, really awkwardly.
Specifically all of the men she had a crush on.
Called
them up on stage and says, I'm going to go backstage and kind of grope at you. Yeah, and
like, there's a new COVID test that's going to involve me jamming my tongue down your throat. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, should we really be making light of that? I get that we're reversing the expectation and having it be her sexually harassed men, but it's still not the kind of thing we want to normalize and say is okay and fair game, right? Isn't that kind of weird and fucked up? Can we all agree on that? No? Okay. Mm-hmm. That was weird. And then, of course, there was Chris Rock getting slapped in the face by Will Smith.
That's where all the memes are coming from. Yeah. That's all anybody talked about the next day.
Well, it was weird. It was a weird moment in its entirety. Yeah. Chris Rock made a joke about Jada Pinkett's hair. I don't know if he knew that she had alopecia and that her hairstyle was not a personal choice, but actually a result of a condition that she had. If he did, really fucked up. If he didn't, perfectly understandable for Will Smith to tell him to shut his goddamn mouth. Shouldn't have hit him, though. I mean, I think we can all agree on that.
Walked up on stage on television and smacked him in
the
face. It was
a shit joke, and Chris Rock Will Smith is absolutely in his rights to get in Chris Rock's face about it, but you shouldn't hit somebody. It was a weird moment where, A, that just fucking happened, and B, we were all having, like, ostensibly a nice time, and then there was violence.
Hmm.
Not life-threatening violence, obviously, but it's just like, that is like, I would like to leave the room now uncomfortable. Like, it's really weird and off-putting, and that sucked.
No comment. I don't want to talk about it.
I had to mention it because it's the elephant in the room, but it's just, none of that shit was great.
I will say that, to his credit, Chris Rock kept the show going.
Yeah.
After that.
He took a moment. He took the hit. He took a moment, and then he moved on.
Yeah.
Point and, made.
And he was like a little taken aback, and he just very professionally said, "Wow, Will Smith just slapped the crap out of me."
I like that moment where this all of a sudden this dawning realization, this is the greatest night in the history
of television. Yeah, he continues, "Welcome to the greatest night in the history of television." The host just got slapped by one of the biggest movie stars in the world.
Yeah, that was just really good. And made everything. He won an Oscar after that, and every single thing he said, unintentionally or otherwise, had a weird double meaning, where he was talking about protecting families and love, and it just ended up being really weird.
Will and Jada Pinkett are, they're Scientologists. They have some weird Scientologist beliefs about behavior and psychology, and I've seen the movies that Will Smith has made, especially as something like After Earth, where it's sort of about where Sun plays his son, and he's like, it's about how he is
this, that weirdly personal. Yeah,
it's weirdly personal, but it's also about how you're not supposed to feel fear, and fear is this kind of psychological weakness, and it's about overcoming and becoming kind of emotionally dead, and that's a strength. There's a lot of weird stuff going on in After Earth. And so
it's easy to want to try to connect those things, but we don't know what's going on.
I don't know
what's
going on.
It was just awkward.
He's said and done some awkward things. That's all I'm going to say about it.
Yeah, we'll let it.
I'm not going to say who is in the right or who is in the wrong.
I would say everyone has some growing up to do. That's all I'm going to say.
It's an odd moment that someone thought to get up and slap the host of the Oscars.
Yeah. So anyway, other than that, not a lot of huge surprises. Coda won Best Picture. Good for Coda. It's a sweet film.
I think Coda's just fine. I like it a lot. I think it's very sweet. It's very moving. It's a good family drama. The performances are all great. It's completely solid.
I'm genuinely surprised that the only Oscar The Power of the Dog won was for Best Director.
I'm glad
it won Best Director, but this is the first film to only win Best Director since The Graduate.
It's
weird.
Second year in a row where a woman won Best Director, which is
that's
really
a good
nice.
Thing.
Third time in history. Jane Campion, who I think has been nominated a couple times before.
Just once, for The Piano.
The Piano, okay.
And I think she won for the screenplay for The Piano, so there you go.
Okay, but it's nice that she finally got her due. She's kind of a well-established director who does constantly puts out good films.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I also thought it was really, really... There was a nice little moment where... Who won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress last year from Minari?
Oh, yeah.
She came out to announce the winner of the previous year's Best Supporting Actress always announces Best Supporting Actor the next year, and so on.
And vice versa, yeah.
It was a really, really sweet moment where she gave the award to Troy Kotsur, and she carried the award for him on stage so that he could sign his acceptance speech.
Yeah.
And there was this one guy who was like trying to nudge her, like, "Hey, get off the stage." And she's, "No,
I'm holding his statue.
I'm holding his statue so he can sign you. What the hell?" But like, it was actually kind of sweet and nice. And I like that.
I like that there was, when Coda won Best Picture, they had multiple interpreters for deaf audiences, but also for the actors. When people were talking, there was an interpreter facing them so they could also hear the speech.
About her name is Yunya Jung, by the way. I apologize, that was
one more debacle that we can discuss. It was just an embarrassment all the way through. There was a really kind of boneheaded idea where the producers of the show thought they could sort of lure people into show by polling viewers. It's like this People's Choice Award thing. It's like, we're going to let you choose one of the awards, and that way you kind of get a little bit of a mention. And so they had things like the best cheer moments in movies. Yeah. What made you stand up and cheer in all of film history?
Yeah, the top five winners were from 1999 onward. Shocking, but I don't think it's in the spirit of the
thing.
One
was from 1999, and then the others were from, like, later than, like, 2018.
Yeah, there was, like, Dreamgirls. Dreamgirls was the other one. It was The Matrix.
The Matrix.
When Neo dodged bullets Then there was, I was
impressed by that scene, but I didn't like.
I didn't cheer for that moment. There was I'm telling you, I'm not going from Dreamgirls, which actually, yeah, that's a good pick. It's not bad.
People were applauding afterwards.
That's cool. And then there was when there was when they said Avengers Assemble and Avengers Endgame, and then when all three Spider-Mans teamed up in Spider-Man No Way Home, and then of course the winner.
And I don't even know what this phrase means.
It was the Flash becomes one with the Speed Force.
It was the Flash enters the Speed Force.
Yes, the Flash enters the Speed Force.
I don't know what that means.
It means he ran so fast he basically became pure energy.
Okay.
That's a scene that happened in Zack Snyder's Justice League, the director's cut. And sure enough, the other online award that they gave for fan favorite film of the year, the first two, like they gave they ranked them. Like number five was Spider-Man. Like number four was Tick Tick Boom, actually, which I'm surprised did so well.
Well, good.
Yeah, and then like I forget the order, but like number three was like Minamata.
Yeah, which was
a barely released Johnny Depp film,
and there was some sort of politics. I wish I had them in the tip of my brain, but there was some sort of politics about the release of this film.
Yeah,
where it barely got released, and it was
Johnny Depp is kind of, you know, had a lot of trouble history, and it's kind of hard to get his movies released right now.
Well, and that because of that, his film was barely released, and a lot of Johnny Depp's fans who were defending him after. He was pilloried for abuse.
Yeah.
And then it turned out it was a lot more complicated.
But he
was also being abused.
That's a weird scenario. We're not going to get into that.
Yeah, but I think just a lot of people were sort of rallying because of all of this backstage drama.
Oh, yeah. His fans stuffed the ballot box. That's what they did. Yeah. Which is also why the Amazon original musical Cinderella came in number two.
And why a lot of people watched it. Sure, why not?
And why number one was... Not Justice League, that was ineligible, so they gave it to Army of the Dead,
the other Zack Snyder film.
It was like all of these like big inspirational moments from all these movies, and then a zombie attacking a helicopter as it falls off a building. And apparently it went over like a lead balloon, like no one applauded it in the actual theater. Much like the other awards that they gave out previously, they just sort of shoved it in. Like, really, I thought they were going to a commercial. And it's like, oh, by the way, we're doing this thing. Like, there wasn't an announcement. They didn't have someone come out and say anything. It was basically just like, oh, by the way. Whoops. Turns out, if you poll the internet, the only people you're actually polling are the people whose fandoms are dedicated enough to stuff a ballot box. Which is how it works. So... Yeah, I don't think we're going to be doing that again.
It's the Bodie McBoatface syndrome.
Exactly, yeah. The Oscars are flailing. They're absolutely stuck in desperation. And all I'm going to say about it is this. I've talked a lot about what I think could save the Oscars.
Well, everybody does. That's a common topic of punditry.
I think you get the Muppets to host or Murder Mystery.
I loved your idea for the Murder Mystery. Yeah, like the host comes out and then a shot ring or something dramatic. They take a drink and they choke very melodramatically and fall on the stage.
And then Daniel Craig comes out as Benoit Blanc. Or if he can't get him, Kenneth Branagh plays Poirot or something. And... they solve the mystery throughout the evening. They're interviewing the celebrity guests. It's just like, where were you, Javier Bardem? Like, that kind of thing. It's just who you can get. They just turn into an ongoing bit. And then
now presenting our next award, Jessica Chastain and Vinny the Knife.
Yes, and then right before you announced Best Picture at the end of the year, you would do something like, here to announce Best Picture is Harrison Ford. And then Benoit Blanc, like, pulls off Harrison Ford's mask, and it's actually...
Rogen or something.
Someone. That's the joke, and then they announce it. Just you make a through line because there was one of the better jokes was from Wanda Sykes, who said, the Oscars, where people come to celebrate the art of cinema by watching TV, and they've always struggled with that.
Yeah,
it's never really felt cinematic at the Oscars. Well, it's always been chasing basically. Variety television dynamics from the 1950s. That's all it's ever really been.
You'll go back a little further. It's actually trying to capture a stage bonanza.
Well,
it's like the Hollywood Review.
That's trying to.
And, you know, they've always had, you know, musical performances, and they've thrown in like this dance stuff. It took them a long time to get used to sort of the TV montage.
Yeah.
Where they'd have all of these montages, they'd have...
clips from shows.
In previous years, they've had these completely bizarre things, like our favorite musical moments and from movies throughout history, and it's just kind of vaguely thematically connected movies.
Yeah.
what was it called? The Academy Award winning short that sort of pioneered that. I think it was Chuck Workman's Precious Images.
I don't know.
It was it was just clips of movies set to a score.
Ah.
And just from all throughout film history. You know,
yeah.
High prestige, low prestige. There's, mm-hmm. you know, monster movies. It's Fiddler on the Roof. It's Rocky Horror Picture Show. Yeah. It's Casablanca. It's Frankenstein. Yeah. All of that stuff. Let me look up Precious Images, because I forgot what year that came out. But that was sort of where the Academy started to incorporate, like,
clip shows.
The idea that this is a medium.
Yeah.
Like, the actual medium into the show.
Real fast, since we're talking about those montages, the In Memoriam segment was unusual this year for two reasons.
Because it
also sucks. Well, it wasn't great, but there are two things they did really, really differently.
1986 was Precious Images.
There's two things they did really, really differently at the In Memoriam. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's the part in every Academy Awards ceremony where they just do a montage of all of the Academy Award winners or major people in the industry who passed away in the previous year. It's usually very melancholic and very, very sad for obvious reasons. They did two things differently this year, one of which I'm fine with, one of which I think was a mistake. Usually the music that they play is really sad, mournful, funeral-type music. Here they decided to go in a different direction and have it be sort of inspirational.
Like they did Spirit in the Sky was one of them.
That one was a little crass, but I honestly thought the idea of, instead of making this just purely about sadness and making it about celebrating their lives, not bad.
Mm.
Not bad. Didn't quite stick the landing, but I'm not offended by that. The problem was you had choreographed dance routines. You should not be distracting from that montage.
No.
I don't want to say sacred, but that montage is meant to be taken seriously, and you shouldn't be distracting attention away from it. That was a mistake.
The part I didn't like is they would stop the montage every once in a while and have someone step out and say, oh, here's one of our favorite dead people.
Oh, yeah.
Ivan Reitman passed away, so we're going to get
Ivan Reitman deserves extra care, or Betty White deserves extra moments. Oh, I did appreciate that at least Jamie Lee Curtis tried to do something for her favorite charity. That was kind of nice. But
And John Travolta adopted that dog.
What?
Yep. She was carrying a little puppy on stage saying, hey, somebody should adopt this adorable puppy. It needs a home. And John Travolta just said, okay, give me that puppy.
You know what? That's really sweet, actually.
Yeah, John Travolta with his kid is like posing online.
How nice a moment would that have been at the Academy Awards? Yeah, Wouldn't that have been uplifting and sweet?
Let's celebrate the 28th anniversary of Pulp Fiction.
Oh my God, that went on forever.
So
they were so bored. Okay, and the anniversary of White Men Can't Jump, where they were just talking about who is more stoned right now, which is funny for a second. Mm. We gotta move on.
Woody Harrelson,
I'm watching this and I'm like, we could have fit in two of those eight Academy Awards we missed.
Woody Harrelson probably was stoned.
I'm sure he was.
And
I wouldn't be surprised if Wesley Snipes was too.
Wesley Snipes is so I think he's just laid back. I think he has a weed gland. Like, he's just... just glands some drugs into his brain. Yeah, I'm laid back. Yeah. I've also got to interview Wesley. It's starting to be some name-droppy, but...
Well, we have a personal experience with this.
Just Wesley Snipes is one of those actors, like, he walks into a room and you're like, yeah, point a camera at that guy.
Yeah.
He just has that it quality.
Yeah, he's
just really, really, really dazzlingly charming. Yeah. And so, yeah, you get him on stage, it's like, yeah, I'm cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are. You should play a superhero or something. Oh, do another Blade. Do it now.
Well, Mahershala Ali is the new Blade, but maybe they'll get Wesley Snipes to be the old Blade and do a team up, because everything's got an alternate reality now.
Sure, why not?
Anyway, so the Academy Awards, the awards themselves, you know, I wrote a review of it for The Wrap, and I said basically what people forget about the Academy Awards is the show is only as good as the awards.
Mm.
The awards are what we're here for. We're here to see big moments where people feel appreciated. Or even moments where people feel unappreciated.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, that's what we're here. And you just, every time you distract focus away from that, you just create filler.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of filler. And most of the filler was shitty. And it was not a good show. Just respect the awards.
Yeah.
I'm not even saying they deserve respect. But if we're going to watch it, at least let's pretend that we're here for a reason. Rather than just try to take the piss out of everything. So, in any case, we'll be back to talk about the Oscars again next year, when I'm sure they will have learned nothing. Moving on, let's review some new movies. Now, this is an odd week, because we didn't see any of the same films. And indeed, I only had time to see one.
I only had a chance to see two. I try to see at least three a week, so I apologize. Yeah.
A bit of a, you know, we like to overachieve, but we like to watch as many movies as we can, so we can talk about as many movies as we can, and we can spread the word about as many movies as we can. But the Oscars were this week, and they kind of sucked up all the air. So Let's talk about, I guess, the technically biggest movie that opened this weekend. I think it did okay at the box office. Tell me about The Lost City.
The Lost City, originally called The Lost City of D, and I'm not sure why they dropped the of D part.
Maybe they thought it was, maybe it was too much like The Lost City of Zed.
Yeah.
Which, you know, which didn't make money, so they thought maybe it was confusing.
This is a high-concept Hollywood comedy based on an original idea, which we don't get a lot of anymore.
And not,
which,
not with a budget, no.
Yeah, which used to be sort of, when I was growing up, these were my favorite kinds of movies.
Yeah.
This is my bread and butter. I was very fond of films like a lot of John Candy movies, like Delirious and Once Upon a Crime.
Which one was Once Upon a Crime?
Mr. Destiny. It was a big mistaken identity kind of crime
plot. Mr. Destiny was Jim Belushi. It wasn't John Candy, but yeah.
Just that era of comedies. Yeah. Those were the films I was watching.
Yeah, feel good.
Say what you will about my taste.
Projects,
I was a kid. Say what you will about my taste. Here's another one of those. Big cool. Middle-budget Hollywood comedy starring recognizable, legit movie stars. It stars Sandra Bullock as a one-time archaeology student.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to actually delve into caves and do, you know, Indiana Jones-style archaeology. But no one was paying attention to her academic papers. So she and her husband passed away, who has also shared this passion with her. So she kind of felt a little bit alienated from her passion, started writing romance novels with an Indiana Jones type bent. And those turned out to be really, really popular. Also because they had a really hunky cover model, Fabio style, played by Channing Tatum.
Ah, okay. Good cast.
And when they go on book tours, he's always there. And he gets most of the attention because he's the hunky guy in the open shirt and the long.
That tracks.
Meanwhile, she's like a little bit of a shy nerd in that way that only Sandra Bullock can really play. Where she's actually like a dazzling movie star, but we're supposed to buy that she's really awkward.
How does she do that?
That's her thing.
Because usually it's like, come on. But like, when Sandra Bullock does it, you're just like, I buy it. I don't know how you got away with that. You shouldn't. You're Sandra Bullock, for crying out loud.
The plot of the movie is Sandra Bullock is approached by a super billionaire played by Daniel Radcliffe.
Okay.
Who wants to hire her to come to this distant island in the middle of the Atlantic. Where a volcano is about to go off, but there's a cave there that needs to be excavated really quickly.
Uh-huh.
And he hasn't deciphered the hieroglyphs.
Okay.
And he needs her because he knows that she actually has some real expertise in addition to being a romance novelist.
Okay, so it's not like he thinks the romance novels are real. He needs her because she's actually an archaeologist.
He knows that the stuff she's putting in the books is real, and he needs her expertise.
Because she's an archaeologist, she's putting actual archaeology in there.
That's right. He's actually been excavating already, and he just needs like one last chamber so he can get this MacGuffin that's hidden.
Reasonably well thought out, okay.
She says no. I'm not exactly sure why she says no.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, this is not my adventure. I don't want to go on an adventure. And so he kidnaps her,
drugs
her, and puts her on his private plane and like chains her to chairs and says, you have to translate this.
And that's when she calls her cousin, Kathleen Turner.
Like Romancing the Stone. Because
it sounds a little like Romancing the Stone.
Well, the difference is Romancing the Stone is funny.
Burn. Burn.
The Lost City is a fucking drag.
No, because you're making it sound kind of fun.
Well, it has a good high concept. I think this is a fine idea to sort of set up this comedic misadventures where these characters who are unprepared to go on an adventure have to go on an adventure together.
And I imagine Channing Tatum has to kind of fill his role as the cover hero, but he's bad at it.
Well, at first he hires a real cover hero, played by Brad Pitt.
Okay.
And Brad Pitt shows up and he's just unendingly capable. And there's, you know, action sequences where he just sort of sneaks into the bad guy's camp and knocks out a bunch of people and tries to rescue Sandra Bullock.
It's like rather clever of Channing Tatum actually to do that.
And he wants to come along. So like as Brad Pitt will knock a guy out, and as he's falling, Channing Tatum will sort of like slap him on the way down and says, I helped. So he's completely incapable.
It's kind of funny.
But because of the circumstances of the film, they're separated and they have
Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum
have to go off into the jungle together. this is a prime case of just horrendous ADR trying to cover a lot of comedic ground. So there's a lot of shots of like people's backs walking away from the camera while they're kind of like nattering off in the background, sort of bickering at each other, and that's supposed to be funny. It's like, I think I got a leech on my butt kind of stuff.
This wasn't funny, so we added jokes in post.
Exactly. There's a lot of jokes in post.
Patton Oswalt had a great bit about that. That was called doing punch-ups. Mm-hmm. When you get a bunch of comedians in a room after a movie's already done to add in jokes that you can fit in post.
Yeah, like shouting things from off camera.
Yeah, usually shouted, but sometimes just, you know, little things people say as they're walking off camera or whatever like that. And he would talk about, like, oh no, I fell on some butterscotch. Scotch. Like, I guess the concept of a joke is funny. And that's, yeah. Once you start, like, actually paying attention to it, I took a class in sound design in film school, and it changed my life.
Because once you start noticing that stuff.
You can tell the difference between ADR and actual, like, recorded on set, you hear it everywhere. Mm. And it's abundantly clear which movies were either shot so fast that they missed, that they couldn't get good sound, or they missed coverage, or they had to rework everything in the editing room, and they needed straight dialogue in order just to keep the plot going. We had to cut a whole scene, and now we needed a line of dialogue to do the work.
There's even cases where they can't get the original actors back, so they try to get sound-alikes, and they don't really sound that well, or they're clearly recording in the booth and not on set.
I think every time I watch Live Free or Die Hard, it drives me up the goddamn wall, like so much of that movie. Especially at the beginning, just setting it up.
There was a line in, of all things, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where the character of R.K. Maroon is standing in the background, and you can see his mouth, even though he's out of focus, and his line of dialogue is, "You got a lot of balls coming here by yourself." Uh-huh. But clearly they didn't want the word balls in there.
They decided later on it was going to give him a PG-13, and they didn't want
it. So they changed it to, "You got a lot of brass coming here by yourself," which is fine. That's a fine cover.
Perfectly good replacement,
But they clearly didn't have the original actor's voice. They got some other guy. So all of a sudden, like, out of nowhere with completely different sound quality, you got a lot of brass coming here by yourself. and Bob Hoskins, like, looks kind of surprised. It's like he's responding to the bad recording. Unfortunately, this is pretty pervasive throughout The Lost City. I think if you're going to have a comedy like this that is sort of putting a comedic situation in an adventure movie, the adventure movie has to work as well.
Yeah, you can't half-ass it.
Yeah, and like, this looks really cheap. It looks like a comedy film where everything's kind of oversaturated. The sets aren't all that convincing.
See, that's why
they put a little bit of money into some like wide establishing shots or a few sets, but it looks really kind of rinky-dink. And really kind of hurts the movie.
That's why Romancing the Stone worked. But in addition to just being well cast and well written, Robert Zemeckis, who directed that movie, if you've never seen Romancing the Stone, by the way, it's great. Kathleen Turner plays a romance adventure author whose sister or cousin, I forget who, gets kidnapped in the jungle, and she travels down to save him and teams up with a local guy played by Michael Douglas, and they get in a bunch of adventures, and it's really, really funny. Mm-hmm. If there were no jokes in it, that movie would still work.
Exactly.
It's still a reason. Robert Zemeckis knew he has to work as an adventure film and a romance. Otherwise, the comedy won't be enough to carry it.
Yeah,
that's something that if you're going to satirize a genre, you have to be able to do the genre. Otherwise, you're just doing it's just sour grapes. Mm.
They're not really committing to the genre. This might be COVID stuff, or this just maybe saving money. But there's a lot of like sets and blue screens that look just increasingly terrible as time goes on. It seems like I think their productions have to be so quick now that they're trying to do as much as they can in the studio. Mm-hmm. And as such, the films look a lot worse, which is weird because this is like a $70 million movie. You'd think it would look a little bit better, or they would go someplace where they could actually shoot on location and get, you know, some better photography on here. They could record jokes and think of them, work them out as jokes ahead of time rather than just sort of rambling a lot. Scenes where we get to see Channing Tatum's butt and where Sandra Bullock is picking leeches off of his butt aren't... Well, the theater I was in seemed to like them, but I didn't think that was very funny. A lot of people were hooting and hollering at Channing Tatum's bottom. I was just... Mr. Grumpus Puss, I'm afraid, when I was watching The Lost City. I was just sitting there with my arms folded, waiting for a while, and after a while, just sort of challenging it to get me to laugh.
Do you follow? No, Lon Harris is a friend of ours. He's on the Schmodown. I actually used to work with him at a video store on here in Los Angeles before it closed down, called Laser Blazer. Yeah, this is like 15 years ago now.
Lon Harris is a very funny man, very good funny writer. He wrote until recently for Honest Trailers.
Does he not do that anymore? I thought he still did that.
Maybe he still does, but I know he moved over to a YouTube show called Some More News.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's writing for that now.
Lon's very, very funny. He's got great taste in movies, and he's got a theory right now about a new genre we need to properly coin called a Red Notice.
Named after the movie 2022 film Red Notice.
I asked him what's the definition of a Red Notice, and he tweeted it, and I want to give him credit because it sounds like The Lost City is a Red Notice. So here's his definition of a Red Notice. And if you're going to have a genre, you need to define a genre. There need to be tangible things you can point to. It's not quality. It's about specific elements of the story or the filmmaking that most films in the genre share. Maybe they don't have all of them, but they usually have most or some.
Yeah.
So Lon Harris's definition of a Red Notice, which is based on the Ryan Reynolds, Dwayne Johnson, Gal Gadot movie. One, straddles the action, comedy, caper, and adventure genres, but commits to none. Is international and globetrotting in scale.
Okay.
3 to 5 stars is in leads, typically playing a seasoned pro, snark machine, and outsider or third wheel.
Mm-hmm.
Typically involve a string of mini missions, especially heists. Frequently involve a lot of obvious green screen work. Frequently feature a scene in which the characters attend a fancy event, such as a gala ball in formal wear.
Okay.
Recent examples include Free Guy, Jungle Cruise, and Uncharted. Is The Lost City a Red Notice?
No.
Oh.
No. It does have the three leads thing, because it has Channing Tatum, Sandra Bullock, and Daniel Radcliffe.
It sounds like it's straddling the genres.
Yeah, it's sort of like comic, caper, romance, adventure picture.
Okay. It's definitely globetrotting.
It doesn't have that episodic nature where it's like it has a lot of different locations where they have a lot of different missions along the
definitely
way.
Definitely missing that.
And there's no snarky, jokey character.
Okay. So, couple of things. So it's quasi Red Notice. Yeah.
Oh, I guess there is kind of a snarky, jokey character. You know what? Let me amend that.
Is there a gala where people like show up in like fancy clothes?
There's a Divine Joy Randolph is in this movie.
Oh, well, there you go.
She plays Sandra Bullock's agent who ends up chasing after her and ends up having to sort of make her own way.
Is there a fancy party of some kind or a fancy event?
The action is kicked off at a book release party.
Okay, but that counts.
It's not like a huge fancy gala. It looks really cheap. It was clearly like shot in a hotel ballroom.
I think the concept. It sounds like you got a Red Notice, dude. You got Red Notice.
Maybe so.
You went to the theater. You put in good money, and you got Red Notice.
Seeing as Lon Harris has coined the phrase, I would want to run it by him first. But maybe so. Maybe this is a Red Notice.
I will ask. I will try to remember to ask Lon to listen to this episode and give us his take.
Whatever the genre is, I think it sucks. It's not enjoyable. I was not laughing. I wasn't having a good time. The energy level is really low. It doesn't crescendo. It doesn't feel like a good adventure picture. It needs to be an adventure picture with comedy in it, not a comedy film with adventure elements.
Yeah,
and,
that's always death.
And yeah, so it feels really kind of fake and lightweight, and it looks really cheap even though it was expensive.
Nah.
And Sandra Bullock is just sort of doing her thing.
Yeah.
If you're a Sandra Bullock fan, fine, go see her.
She kind of on autopilot?
No, she's selling it. She's there, but I'm unimpressed.
Well, okay. fair enough. All right, well, moving on. I saw a new horror movie.
Tell me about the new horror movie.
It is called You Are Not My Mother. And spoiler alert, unless my mom is listening to the podcast right now, you're not.
Is it based on that book where the little bird thinks that the dog is its mom?
I highly doubt it.
And then it meets a snort and it gets scared.
I'm pretty sure.
The snort is a steam shovel.
Unless it's an incredibly loose adaptation, I say no. Okay. This is a new film from writer-director Kate Dolan. I think it's their first feature. Mm. And it is an Irish horror film about a teenage girl who is living in a house with some severe mental health issues that are not being addressed. Her mother is suffering from extreme depression, possibly bipolar. They're not too specific about it, but definitely depression is part of it. And her grandmother is into some weird stuff. And at first we can't tell if she's into witchcraft or if she's specifically just, into folksy old remedies or whatever. And it's entirely possible, as we're watching over the course of the film, that the way Grandma raised Mom is a distinct reason why Mom is the way she is. There's no food in the house. The house is dimly lit. There's not a lot of love there. She's miserable. One day she's running late to school, and her mother agrees to get out of bed for the first time in God knows how long to give her a ride. While they're on the way to school, Mom has a moment where she decides to try to ram the car into a horse. There just happens to be a horse nearby, and she decides to ram the horse, and the kid has to stop her. And she gets out of the car, and she just walks to school, and her mother just says, I can't do this anymore. And when she goes to school, of course she's bullied. Life is really, really hard for her. There's a character named Char, played by Hazel Dupe. I think it's how you pronounce it. D-O-U-P-E. When she comes home, she sees that the car is still where she left it. The doors are open, and her mom is missing. And they don't find her for a while. And then a couple of days later, she comes back, doesn't really explain where she's been, and maybe she's a monster now. Or maybe...
I feel like I've seen a movie like that. This was the plot of that movie Relic.
I didn't see Relic.
Yeah.
Which
I think is also an Australian movie.
This is Irish.
Oh, you said it was Irish.
This is Irish, sorry.
I apologize.
Relic is Australian. This is Irish. It's one of those movies where you're watching it the entire time and you're not sure how literal you're supposed to be taking this. Like, is any sort of sense of the supernatural just a metaphor for how harrowing it can be to grow up in a household with mental illness that has gone untreated or undiagnosed? And that's harrowing enough. That's certainly dramatic enough and scary enough in many situations, not universally, but can be, to justify a horror movie. However, Grandma might be a witch. Mom might have something supernatural going on with her. It's kind of hard to tell for a really long time. And I'm watching this movie, and I realize that there's a weird sensation that you get when you're watching this kind of horror movie. Like, when you're watching something like Hereditary, where you're not sure if this is a good movie until you know if it sticks the landing.
Right, right.
You know, you're watching... If this all comes together well, this is a good movie. If they don't have somewhere to go with this... This whole bit, this mounting dread, is going to feel like a waste of time. It's not the same as a slow burn. It's you're in suspense as to whether or not the movie's going to pull this thing off. And I don't know what to call that, but I feel like there should be a name for that.
I reviewed one just like that recently. I already forgot the title.
Oh dear.
The one about the mother and her teenage daughter who are witches.
Oh yeah,
and they and. One of them
that was it was on Shudder.
It was a Shudder film.
It was the something something of the thing.
It was definitely the something something. It wasn't the thing. That's a John Carpenter thing.
Totally different vibe. You're way off.
Hellbender.
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 Yeah, that was close.
the thing. It was called Hellbender. That was a movie that had a lot of good mounting dread.
Yeah.
Had a good relationships, a good setup, and just. The limpest possible payoff.
Yeah.
Like, it just sort of ended.
It needs to go... Like, say what you will about Hereditary. It goes somewhere.
Yeah.
It's.
I actually like that ending.
Whether you like it or not, it's a big end. Like, it matters. Like, it comes to a major conclusion about what happened there.
Somebody enters a treehouse in those final scenes, and it scared the flip out of me.
It's not cool what happens in that film. Except it's quite good. I think it's a little on the nose, but it's a very good movie. So yeah, this doesn't have the same, like, holy shit impact that Hereditary does. Hereditary is one of the better examples of the genre just because it ends with such a bang. But it does, I feel, come to a satisfying conclusion. Whether or not it's supernatural, I'll leave to you. But, like, I do believe that when all is said and done, it earns what it gets.
Okay.
And I think it's what keeps it really in line is a bunch of really, really good performances. Hazel Dupe is a really, really strong young actor. I want to see more of her. Carolyn Bracken plays her mother, and she's got to ride this really thin line between mom's off her meds and mom is actually a monster. And you can't know for certain until really late in the movie. And that's a hard thing to do while still feeling somewhat respectful of mental illness, because it's really dangerous for horror movies to equate supernatural horror to mental illness.
It happens a lot. It can be really, if done well, part of Relic as well.
If done well, it can work, but it can be really irresponsible because on one hand you're kind of scapegoating the supernatural.
Yeah.
Like you know, this actual problem of yours, it's not a big deal. It's just ghosts. It's like it's easy to fix or whatever like that. That's not really doing anyone any good in the audience who's actually living with or suffering from any of this stuff. So that doesn't really, really help. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people who aren't in therapy or don't do a lot of research about it, and they're just kind of picking up what they know about certain things from movies and media. And if enough movies and media treat mental health like it literally turns you into a monster who will kill your own children, that's not doing a lot of good for people who are trying to destigmatize mental health.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that that's out of bounds. I'm just saying it's difficult to do respectfully and responsibly. And I think this movie mostly gets away with it. So, it's not an incredible horror film, but it is a rock solid one. Like the acting is really, really good. It's pretty creepy. A couple of good jump scares in it.
This one's not on Shudder, is it?
No, It'll be. Right. I'm sure it'll find its way there somewhere similar pretty soon. But it's having a small theatrical release. It's called You Are Not My Mother. If you like that kind of horror movie, that kind of hereditary, what is going on in this house kind of horror movie, this is a really good example of it.
Okay.
You know, not top five maybe, but certainly, three star, whatever, just solid.
I recommend Relic.
All right, then.
I think Relic's very good.
All right, and then the last movie we're reviewing this week is a film that you saw, I didn't, and I really wanted to, and we had to record. I was going to try to go see it tomorrow, but whatever. So tell me about Everything Everywhere All at Once, because I hear good things.
Everything Everywhere All at Once is a film by a director team, Daniel Kwan and Daniel, other guy. They're both named Daniel, so they are credited as Daniels.
Well, that makes sense.
That's their Daniel Scheinert
and Scheinert,
Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert directed this film together. Michelle Yeoh plays the owner of a laundromat, and she is living a pretty hectic life. Her dad, who's played by James Hong, is in for a New Year's celebration that they're just going to throw at the laundromat because they don't really have anywhere else to go.
Right.
She is kind of butting heads with her teenage daughter, who's played by an actress named Stephanie Hsu, and because her daughter is trying to come out to the family. She has a girlfriend. She wants to bring her girlfriend to this party. Her husband is played by Ke-Hu Kwan, who
was Short Round in the Indiana Jones Temple of Doom.
He was a child actor who was in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. He was in The Goonies.
Cool to see him back.
Acting. He was also doing like stunt choreography for a while.
Oh, I didn't know that. Actually.
And he was also an assistant director on Wong Kar-wai's 2046. So he's had a pretty interesting career, this guy.
I didn't know that. That's cool. He was also in Turning Red really recently.
Yeah, just did a little voice acting in that one.
No, just to say no.
But their marriage might be on the rocks.
Oh, wait, no, that was James Hong. Sorry, I was looking at the wrong...
Oh, no, James Hong was in...
I was looking at the wrong... I was looking at the IMDb page, and it was a shot from Everything Everywhere All at Once. And they're both in the shot, so I got confused. My bad. Sorry.
James Hong, who's all right. James Hong, who's like 94, and he's still lively.
Legendary character actor. Oh, my God, he's been in everything.
The laundromat is being audited. This all sounds like sort of a slice of life drama, and there's like some energy here, but poor Michelle Yeoh, she plays a character named Evelyn, is just completely overwhelmed by all of this, and she has to go to the tax office and face off against this evil auditor played by Jamie Lee Curtis, and Jamie Lee Curtis is having a great time playing this completely like evil, boring character. Like, you realize you don't have the right receipts, and she's like the teacher you don't want to have.
Yeah.
And Jamie Lee Curtis is having a great time. While she's at the tax assessor's office, while in the elevator, her husband's eyes flutter, and he suddenly turns into a different version of himself.
Oh.
And he turns to her and says, "I need you to follow these instructions," and hurriedly passes a note to her. And while she's listening to Jamie Lee Curtis, she looks at it and says, "If you want to talk with me, we need you to slip out of your body and meet me in the janitor's closet over there." And so she switches her shoes, which is part of this ritual, and all of a sudden she's, like, magically teleported into the broom closet where her husband also is standing, like another version of him.
Okay.
And he explains, "I'm from the Alphaverse." And Michelle Yeoh's like, "Okay, what?" "I'm from the Alphaverse, and Over in the Alphaverse, we're the original universe that figured out how to, what we call, verse jump. And that is, people from the Alphaverse can shunt their consciousness into alternate reality versions of themselves.
Ah.
But in order to do so, in a kind of Douglas Adams twist, they have to do something really weird and unexpected. Hence why she had to switch her shoes.
Ah.
So, he has to do weird things like, you know, eat a sugar packet or, you know, turn his pants backwards. You know, odd things like that.
Yeah. Something sort of break the code. Yeah.
And he says, all of your realities are in danger because this very strange being called Jobu Tupaki has been jumping throughout the universe and has figured out to essentially reach their consciousness out into all the universes simultaneously. So they are essentially millions of people at the same time and has all of the experiences of all of those people. And Jobu Tupaki is inhabiting the body of your teenage daughter. So what you need to do is use your inherent psychic abilities to reach out to other parallel universe versions of yourself, live as them for a few moments, return and come back with all of their experiences. So she's able to essentially absorb lifetimes worth of experiences by shunting her consciousness into parallel universe versions of herself.
This sounds like Jet Li in The One, but good.
Kehu Kwan worked on choreography for The One,
so maybe
there was a little bit of cross influence going on.
Maybe
who's to say?
The One was starred Jet Li as a guy who had alternate reality versions of himself that were being killed by another alternate reality versions of himself. Because every time he did, he got more powerful, like in Highlander.
Well, there's like a finite amount of like power that can be spread amongst all of the alternate versions of yourself. Like,
every single version of you has a certain amount of energy in it, and if one dies, it gets dispersed to all the others.
To all the others,
And if enough of you get killed, the rest of you become like superheroes, which is terrible. What about all the alternate realities where someone dies first? Like, you can't all die at the same time. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
So Michelle Yeoh is able to put her consciousness briefly into another version of herself. Like, here she's a teppanyaki chef, so now she's really good with knives.
Right.
Here she is Michelle Yeoh. And she goes into, like, essentially reality and borrows Michelle Yeoh's fighting skills. Michelle Yeoh's an experienced martial artist unto herself.
Okay, that's clever. That's
so, that's kind of a cute little twist. And when she finally gets to face off against this mysterious Jobu Tupaki.
Yeah, don't ruin it.
Well, it's inhabiting the body of her teenage daughter, but Jobu Tupaki is able, because they're living multiple universes simultaneously, and is able to essentially warp reality to their will. Jobu Tupaki, every 5 seconds, turns into another version of themselves. It's like those disguise suits from the movie A Scanner Darkly, where she's just constantly like shifting throughout identities and all these like wild costumes every 5 minutes. And you know, in another universe, you're a duck, and all of a sudden she turns somebody into a duck.
Wow. Okay.
Okay, we've introduced this weird action movie premise where there's all this kind of like weird science fiction magic going on where people are splitting into alternate universes and there's like splitting screens.
It's very Wachowski of them.
And then we get to the main idea of the thing.
Okay.
Jobu Tupaki has been amassing essentially.
Again, don't spoil it? Okay, we're good.
This is not a twist. This is just sort of like the ultimate motivation. Has been assembling everything into one place.
Ah.
And because Jobu Tupaki is a nihilist, that everything is an everything bagel. That holds all of the world's nihilism.
Okay.
And Michelle Yeoh and thousands of other Michelle Yeohs now have to gather up enough, I'm not going to call it positive energy, just legit optimism and reason to live in order to fight the nihilism bagel put together by an absurdist. So
this sounds so Douglas Adams.
There's a lot of Douglas Adams in there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of just sort of flip use of philosophy. And there's also a lot of just bizarre action sequences besides, because she has to fight up against all of these other sort of agents from the multi-universal front or whatever it was. And in order to gain more power, of course, they have to do random stuff.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden they're doing things like dressing in bondage gear or you can tell what they're going to use Jamie Lee Curtis's tax assessor trophies for, because they're shaped exactly like butt plugs. And there's going to be a, there's going to be a scene later on where they're used as butt plugs in the middle of a fight scene. So there's a lot of weird, wild stuff. They go to universes where people have hot dogs for fingers. They go to universes where everybody is a rock. And okay. While they're doing all of this, though, we're actually getting a lot more information as to how this is building on the main character. It's not being done simply for style's sake.
Yeah.
A movie we go back to often is a movie called Bunraku. Which came out in like 2011.
We're the only people who talk about this movie.
No, because I think it exemplifies something really important about cinematic style. Bunraku has excellent style. They use a lot of like splashes and animations and you know, anime-inspired visuals.
Bunraku is this really elaborate action movie set in kind of like this kind of fictional Sin City-ish kind of crime universe. Mm. But the overall aesthetic of the movie is all of it. Live-action movie, Japanese puppet theater.
Yeah, it's and it's made to look really artificial.
It made to look like a bunch of puppetry, yeah.
That's a fine idea. I feel like, but with Bunraku, the style is all it has.
Yeah, there's no meaning behind it.
The characters and the story are not that interesting. They're not taking story or ancient theater theatrical traditions from Bunraku theater.
Yeah, you're not going to learn anything, feel anything, grow as a person. You're going to go, well, I hadn't seen like a sword whip out a bunch of like strings and fly around and shit before. Like that's new. But like other than that,
wearing that, use a sword in that way.
Like, and that was a cool shot, but like that's all you're gonna get out of it.
So it was a lot of cool, and it was completely meaningless. And I feel like a lot of filmmakers make that mistake. They try to make things look really cool without realizing that there needs to be an idea behind it. The Daniels have figured out that the idea is actually at the center of this thing. And even though it's presented in all these like really wild, bizarre action sequences and kind of silly Douglas Adams-ish kind of symbology, has actual thought in its head and is actually really trying to get at something. Kehu Kwan is great in playing kind of this sad sack, nebbishy husband who's like really kind of unhappy, but is really trying to be pleasant about how unhappy he is, and then instantly turns into like this badass action hero. I've never seen Michelle Yeoh better.
That's saying a movie, a lot.
Which is saying a lot, because
she's an incredibly talented actor for forever.
She's incredibly talented, but ordinarily, because she's such a skilled martial artist,
She
plays action characters, and action characters tend to have one note. They're like steely determined.
In America in particular, a lot of her Hong Kong films have a lot more nuance. I would say it looks like Wing Chun. There's a lot more going on there.
I haven't seen Wing Chun.
But there's plenty of like just straightforward action roles she's played with aren't a lot of depth to it, but she's always shown that she could do more.
And here she gets to be panicked and funny and out of her element. I've never seen her play such a great range of emotions in a film before.
That's great.
And it all comes down to, you know, this sort of like put upon very sad character finding that there's actually a lot of happiness in the world. This is one of my favorite films of the year.
Wow. And it's only March.
It's only March. I'm surprised I haven't seen others. Last year was great. We charged out of the gate with Psycho Gorman. It came out like the first week of January.
That was good.
Yay, we got a good B movie in January, and we talked about it all year. I haven't seen like one that's really blown me away until now. This movie is astonishingly good.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything that blew me away. I've seen some good movies. Mm. I really like Turning Red. I did like
Turning Red.
I like really liked Fresh a lot. Mm. I really liked Love and Leashes. I've nothing that's like, oh, wow, this blew my goddamn mind. It's so good. I haven't had that yet, so I need to make sure I see this.
This one blew my goddamn mind. I think there's a heck of a lot going on, and there's a lot to discuss, and it's all... It's just like it's an exploding heart. There's just so much love and emotions kind of baked into all of this bizarre style. And it's not using the bizarre style to cover up anything. And it's not using the bizarre style as its raison d'etre. It's kind of, everything's sort of complementing each other. It's a bizarre balance, which I haven't seen done a lot.
Yeah.
It's like it's the film Cloud Atlas wanted to be.
Yeah.
And
which I would argue is a TV series Sense8, but okay.
Maybe so. I didn't see Sense8, but I feel like Cloud Atlas was going for this in broad interconnectivity and how love is sort of this like fundamental missing element of the universe. Like it's a force of nature unto itself.
Right.
And that's something that's baked into this without really getting preachy about it. And yet there's still a lot of sort of discussions about philosophy.
That's amazing.
It feels like the result of maybe the last 5 years where we kind of have realized what with people, you know, the rise of fascism around the world, like authoritarian governments are sort of more popular than ever. We've learned that the kind of online activism that we thought was making a difference was just sort of highlighting how powerless everybody was. So everybody just started to really...
There are notable exceptions to that, but regardless, it has not gone the way we wanted it.
No, no. Yeah. Tweeting something or getting a hashtag to trend is nothing.
Yeah.
It's not doing anything.
Yeah, it actually has to translate into real world action.
Changing your profile picture doesn't
yeah.
do anything. Even donating to a cause doesn't necessarily do anything. Yeah. You know, something more has to be done, and we've realized there's not a lot citizens can do.
Yeah, you know, it makes you feel really helpless if you're not careful.
We felt a lot
yeah.
of helpless in the last 5 years or so, and we've and the temptation towards nihilism is great.
Yeah.
You know, I've read Camus. I know how far off the deep end you can get.
Yeah.
What is the line from Camus? And I wrote a review and I quoted Camus because I'm that kind of asshole. you know, he opened himself up to sort of the benevolent indifference of the universe.
Right.
The universe doesn't care, and that's very freeing. And this is a movie that has that point of view, and it argues that point of view as well, like against that point of view.
Argues against it. Okay, yeah. You know, good.
Well, it makes arguments sort of in both, right. for both characters.
Well, it has the conversation. It's not just trying to ram. That's
so. I think this
sounds
is,
really
the,
good.
So it's like the Daniels are trying to sort of like rewrite the manifesto for a new generation.
Yeah.
This is something that we need to get over. We need to look at where we've been in the last 5 years and realize that there's still hope in all of this crazy shit that we're into. It's so good.
Well then,
what a thing it is.
Well, I suspect I know how you're going to rate the movie now that we're at the end of the episode, because this is where we review movies on our critically acclaimed scale. We review films on a scale of C- to C+. Most movies hover around a C average.
Hmm.
Some good, some bad, better for some audiences than others. C+ is what we give to any movie that we genuinely recommend, whether we simply like it a lot or think it's the best thing ever. And C- is what we give to movies we generally don't recommend. We think they are subpar, either because they're just lacking in just enough ways or because they're absolutely awful and anywhere in between. So on that note, what do you give Everything Everywhere All at Once?
It's a C+, of course. Okay. I like I said, if this... No. This is going to be on my top 10 at the end of the year.
Yeah.
I'm pretty certain. I haven't seen anything quite like this. I was deeply, unbelievably moved. If I see 10 movies greater than this,
right,
then,
we're in for a good
year. We're in for a great year.
Well, fingers crossed. Mm-hmm. Let's see. You Are Not My Mother. I'm going to give it a really high C. It's not like so good you absolutely have to go see it. But if you like this particular genre of horror, it will satisfy you.
Yeah.
It's quite well made. It's just never like astounding. But it's very well crafted, and it deserves to be seen by those who would be interested, just not necessarily run out. Let's see. And then lastly, The Lost City.
Lost City is a C-. I wasn't having a good time with that one.
And then lastly, The Oscars.
That's a big old goose egg one.
It was a couple of cute moments, but
big,
man.
Big flailing fish on a beach. Just,
God,
you know,
damn it.
Just slowly suffocating before our eyes.
Like
last year, when they did it at the train station.
They did the Union Station. That was a weird choice, yeah.
A little bit of an odd show, new venue, COVID restrictions and all the rest.
Sure.
But I think it worked fine. The only weird thing was when they moved Best Actor after Best Picture.
Which they did because they assumed... Because
they assumed Chadwick Boseman, the late Chadwick Boseman, was going to win Best Actor posthumously. And it ended up going to Anthony Hopkins.
Which is why
who wasn't even there.
You cannot, the Oscars are often pretty predictable, but you can't depend on them. You gotta let the awards be the awards. You can't depend on them to help you out.
That was a bit of an awkward moment, but I think overall the show worked fine in that sort of limited capacity. It was a little odd that it was held so late in the year and that they kind of extended the deadlines, but again, that's all COVID stuff.
Yeah.
This year, WTF. I don't know what they're getting at. I don't know what this imaginary audience they think they're trying to get. People who don't go to a lot of movies are their prime audience. What about the people who do?
Yeah, just make it for people who like the Oscars. It's not complicated.
So all of their regular viewers, they kind of lost, and maybe they're just trying to scare away all the old viewers and get new ones.
Yeah, maybe if we stop making movies, they won't bother us anymore. And then we can go home.
To quote Jay Sherman, if you stop going to bad movies, they'll stop making bad movies.
That is sadly not strictly true, but it's a nice idea, isn't it? All right, so that's it for Critically Acclaimed. We'll be back next week with a review of Morbius. It's finally happening. I've been seeing the trailer for this thing for like 3 fucking years, and we're finally going to see
Morbius, the living vampire.
Yeah, it's such a big deal.
It's a vampire movie, but it's like connected to Spider-Man.
Spider-Man
versus a vampire.
Do you remember when they did the 1990s animated Spider-Man cartoon and they put Morbius, the living vampire, in it, but because it was a kid's show, he couldn't be a real vampire.
He still drank people's blood, but it was through like suckers on his
palms.
He
had like lampreys in his hands, and I'm like, you realize that's freakier, right? I can handle someone drinking blood, but having like fucking like starfish in his fingers.
He couldn't say blood, so he kept on saying plasma.
Yeah, which we know where that is. We know where that is.
Well, maybe this one will actually like bite people's necks and drink their blood.
Fingers crossed. Anyway, so we'll be reviewing Morbius and probably a few other things on the next episode of Critically Acclaimed. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Feel free to subscribe if you haven't already. Got a lot of shows here on the network for you. We just did our latest episode of Cancel Too Soon. We reviewed the TV series Terriers. After many, many years of requests, we finally got around to it. Hope you enjoyed it. Let's see. We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive shows on there, including Holy Batman. We've been watching every single episode of the 1960s Batman. We're going to actually continue that in a moment with a crossover episode in a week or two with Cancel Too Soon, because there is an animated series spinoff with the magical Batmite, an interdimensional being who is a huge Batman fan. That was canon. So we'll do that as well. Bunch of cool stuff there. We have All Our Yesterdays. We review every single film ever nominated for Best Picture over at Only the Best. But All Our Yesterdays is where we're reviewing every single episode of Star Trek. We do commentary tracks. We do hangouts. A lot of cool stuff over at the Patreon. Thank you to every single one of our patrons. We wouldn't be here without you. And thank you, everybody, who is thinking of signing up. It means a lot to us. We're on Twitter, at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
But if you'd like to interact with us in a way that other people can hear, you can send us a letter. Our email address is
Letters@criticallyacclaimed.net.
Letters. Wow. I haven't screwed that one up in a while. The email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And what is our snail mail address?
Yeah, send us an actual physical letter. P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, and we might read your email or letter on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail right here on the network. So feel free to ask us questions, take us to task, ask our opinions on things, whatever you want. We're relatively open. We can't get to every letter, but we do try. And of course, the soap store, Etsy. We have a soap store.
That's right.
And my partner, M. Lopez da Silva. We sell soaps over at Salt Cat Soap. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Salt Cat Soap. There'll also be a link to our Etsy store, etsy.com/shop/saltcatsoap. We make, design, and sell designer soaps. Handcrafted, smell really, really lovely. We reveal new soaps every single month on the first Saturday of the month. So stick around. We got some lovely florals coming up for the spring season. But we also have some really cool stuff like caffeinated vampire soap and glow-in-the-dark ghosts and soap that looks like a beach floor, like if you're snorkeling, it looks really cool. So we got a lot of cool stuff over there. So thank you, everybody who's already purchased. And they make great Mother's Day gifts, and now's the time to start thinking about that. So don't wait till the last minute. And I guess that's about it. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And never forget, everyone's Whitney. Everyone's Whitney.
Everyone's Whitney.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?